that the bank would give the investor, basically you, his share or your share of the profits every 6 months, for example. Is that permissible?
Well, there's no objection to this type of deposit mm-hmm. if the money is left with the bank with unrestricted freedom, like choosing this type, like, for example, allowing the bank to choose this type of investment and specifying the investor's share of the profit on their behalf. So actually, it is when the bank is allowed to do this and to invest the money, the bank represents the client. The bank acts on behalf of the depositor. And of course, there's no problem in this kind of transaction because the bank is supposed to invest the money or use the money in any lawful or legal investment or contract. And so there's no problem, there's no objection either in taking the profit made by investing the money. The profit mm-hmm. which is given by the bank to the depositor
right.
is also permissible because the transaction was legal in the first place. And of course, there should also be no problem if the investor was ignorant of the size of the share of the profit, you know, when he was depositing the money, because he did not know how much profit he was going to receive. So even if he was ignorant, the transaction is still allowed and permissible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Shehzad, is it permissible to actually deal with or work with those banks of the foreign countries that are, like, let's say, in enmity with the Muslim world or with the Muslims in general? Is it permissible actually to, for example, deposit any money in a kind of long-term savings account in those banks?
Well, according to the answer given by His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no problem in the transaction in and of itself. Of course, there's no problem. It's permissible to deposit money in the banks of non-Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a condition. Depositing is allowed in and of itself,
right.
provided that this does not lead to strengthening the economy and the power or political power, the economic power of those countries that are working against Islam and the Muslims. If it does not strengthen, if it does not, help those countries gain more power and more strength, then there's no problem in the in depositing money in their banks and also working in those banks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid, is answering some of these questions, in fact, related to the banking and the financial matters, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, we know that there are some banks that work in different areas in the Muslim world, right? And some of them are not owned by the Muslims themselves. Some of them are owned by non-Muslim countries or some private sector somewhere else. Okay?
Yes.
So is the dealing permissible, or are the dealings that you do or any Muslims do with those banks permissible on the condition that, that I said earlier, like the banks are owned by even repressive regimes, for example, all right, or non-Muslim countries? regardless of whether they're like they're owned by or some of the shareholders are Muslim or not?
Well, of course, it depends largely on the type of the transactions made or carried out by the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, there is no objection to being a party to any Shari or lawful and permissible transaction conducted by the banks. And, you know, if the transactions are riba-free or usury-free,
mm-hmm.
and it's not based on usury, then there is no problem. And in there's no objection to someone, to that party receiving the interest or getting the interest from those banks. And of course, let's also, I should say it again, that taking riba or usury from Muslim banks or institutions is not permissible unless the capital of the bank is owned by non-Muslims. Of course, if there is a bank which is run by Muslims, but the capital of the bank belongs to Muslims, of course, in that case, it is permissible to receive interest from that bank.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Sheikh Tawbit, you know, we all know that usually it is the case that in the even the Islamic banking system, that the depositors receive some licit profit interest for their deposits, all right? Wherever they invest their money, the banks, they do it in different ways as they see suitable for themselves, all yes. right? Well, is it permissible for individuals, I mean like private sectors, like you and me, basically, yes. To adopt the same practice as the banks, all right? Well, in other words, is it permissible that you lend money to people in the marketplace, for example, and invest like as they see fit?
Well, if the money is given to the other party in the form of a loan with the condition that the recipient pays monthly or yearly interest at a certain percentage,
mm-hmm.
of course such a transaction is haram. You know, as a matter of religious law or as a matter of you know, Sharia law, because Sharia law does not allow receiving interest or receiving riba, and this transaction is a kind of riba because you as an individual gave money to someone
mm-hmm.
to who's working in the market, and you receive money on a monthly or monthly basis, of course,
right?
And of course, in the event that you stipulate or you place a condition that the other person, the investor, should give you a certain amount of money on a monthly basis, so this is nothing but usury. And as I did mention, if it is a kind of transaction, a legal transaction, something like partnership or juala, or let's say a silent partnership, there's no objection to receiving the money because it is the transaction, it is the partnership that makes things halal. So both the investors are actually are investing money, they are joint, it's a kind of joint venture with two people, with two parties working together to earn profit. And in that case, the profit which is given by the depositor which is given to the depositor is obviously halal. And let me also further add that if the money is deposited with the other party to invest in a Shari type, this is to just paraphrase my mm-hmm. my previous answer. If the money is given by the other party to invest in a Shari type of work or in accordance with a Shari contract, and the money owner gets a given share of the profit made,
yes.
such a transaction is obviously sound, it is valid, and the profits made are also treated as halal, and there's no objection to someone to that individual, to that party receiving the money.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Tawbit. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. The topic was the Islamic laws about, or the questions about the Islamic laws related to banking and financial matters. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
مراقب لطافت روح همسرانمون باشیم. لطافت رو مراقبت میخواد.
People, especially husbands, have to take care of their wives' delicate and fine souls. Men have to be careful with their words. Some words are sharper than the knife, and they scratch the delicate soul of the women. The words that are used by men have to be soft and empty of any kind of harshness. This way, a peaceful relation is established between a wife and a husband. Men must not bother their delicate wives with their tongues. Harsh words and hard looks must be avoided in encountering the women. Allah has created women with a delicate and fine soul. Order and disciplinary behavior is not the solution to peaceful relations between the spouses. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about our program on Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Donald Trump has shied away from criticizing white supremacist Nick Fuentes, but his one-time number two, Mike Pence, called on the ex-president to apologize for the dinner. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Donald Trump repeatedly refused to disavow the outspoken anti-Semite and white supremacist Nick Fuentes after they spoke over dinner at his Mar-a-Lago resort, rejecting the advice from advisers over fears he might alienate a section of his base. Two people familiar with the situation upset. The former U.S. president was urged publicly and privately to denounce Nick Fuentes in the aftermath of the dinner, which included the performer Kanye West, who has also recently been propagating anti-Semitic remarks. But Donald Trump eschewed making outright disavowals of Nick Fuentes, the people said, and none of the statements from the campaign or on his Truth Social account included criticism of Fuentes, despite efforts from advisers who reached Trump over the Thanksgiving holiday. Donald Trump ultimately made clear that he fundamentally did not want to criticize Nick Fuentes, a product of his dislike of confrontation and his anxiety that it might antagonize a devoted part of his base, and became more entrenched in his obstinance the more he was urged to do so. Across three statements on Friday, Donald Trump initially sought only to play down the dinner and made no mention of Nick Fuentes or his views, before saying angrily in a post on his Truth Social website that evening that Kanye West expressed no anti-Semitism and I didn't know Nick Fuentes. The line about not knowing Nick Fuentes was the closest that Trump came to acknowledging the offensive nature of the dinner, under pressure from advisers who warned him that being associated with a racist and a Holocaust denier could further damage his personal brand, as well as his recently launched 2024 presidential bid. But even with his ignorance of Nick Fuentes taken at face value, the statements signal Trump will give extraordinary deference to the most fringe elements of his base, even if it means potentially losing support from more moderate Republicans who have not typically cared for his indulgence of extremism. Donald Trump has had a long history of delaying or muting criticism of white supremacy, drawing moral equivalency in 2017 between neo-Nazis and counter-protesters at the deadly unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, and refusing to denounce the far-right Proud Boys militia group at the 2020 presidential debate. The halting response to Nick Fuentes most closely mirrored his inability to condemn white supremacist groups after Charlottesville, the people said, when Trump faced intense criticism for not naming the right-wing groups in the bloodshed that ended with the death of a young woman. When reached for comment, the Trump 2024 campaign said the former president had a record of combating anti-Semitism, including the appointment of a special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, and strengthening ties to Israel by recognizing Israel's annexation of Golan Heights. The circumstances of the dinner at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday, though, have been a new source of consternation for aides, who privately concede that Kanye West should never have been allowed to meet with Donald Trump in the first place, given his own recent anti-Semitic history. Donald Trump had intended to meet with Kanye West one-on-one for some time, according to a person briefed on the matter, though it was postponed around the time that Kanye West tweeted offensive tropes against Jews, only for it to be inexplicably rescheduled for late November. The former president ended up meeting with Nick Fuentes, who was at the unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, after he came along with Kanye West and a former Trump campaign aide, Karen Giorno. There was only a skeleton staff from Trump's 45 office at the property ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. During the dinner, the person said Nick Fuentes told Donald Trump he was among the former president's supporters, but that he had been unimpressed with the 2024 campaign launch speech because it appeared stilted instead of appearing authentic, with his ad-libs and off-the-cuff remarks. The website politico.com has also covered the same story and gives us more details. A flurry of top Republicans on Monday, 28th of November, took a familiar approach to Donald Trump's dinner with white nationalist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, condemning the former president's actions, but not the man himself. Donald Trump's one-time number two, Mike Pence, was a notable exception, though. President Trump was wrong to give a white nationalist and anti-Semite a seat at the table, Mike Pence told News Nation in an interview. He added, and I think he should apologize for it. Trump's vice president joined several GOP members of Congress in blasting Trump's dinner last week with Nick Fuentes, who has often shared racist and Holocaust-denying content online, and the rapper Kanye West, who has also made anti-Semitic comments. The former president's decision to dine with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West soon after launching his 2024 presidential campaign has already sparked widespread condemnation from Democrats, but Republican lawmakers have been slower to speak out, and most who did so on Monday, 28th of November, stopped short of Mike Pence's call for an apology from Donald Trump. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican senator from Florida who vied against Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential primary, said he hopes to see the former president condemn Nick Fuentes, because I know Trump's not an anti-Semite. I can tell you that for a fact that Trump is not. But Fuentes is evil, just a nasty, disgusting person. And he's trying to legitimize himself by being around a former, maybe a future president. Other Republicans frowned upon the meeting itself while stopping short of outright condemnation. The Senate GOP's number two leader, John Thune of South Dakota, called the dinner a bad idea on every level and said whomever on Donald Trump's staff advised it should be fired. It's ridiculous that he had that meeting, said Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican senator from Iowa, another member of GOP leadership, and that's all I'm going to say about it. Just crazy. Senator Steve Daines, a Republican senator from Montana, condemned the idea of anti-Semitism generally when asked about the meeting, but went no further. We cannot tolerate anti-Semitism, period, said Senator Daines, who's set to chair Senate Republicans' campaign arm for the 2024 election. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota said he wasn't going to condemn anybody, adding that Nick Fuentes is just not somebody that I would have a meeting with. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri struck a similar note, saying while he wouldn't personally dine with Nick Fuentes, it's a free country and Trump can do whatever he wants. Both Senator Mike Rounds and Senator John Cornyn, a Republican senator from Texas, a close ally of Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, said they didn't know who Nick Fuentes was. I'm really not going to spend any more time worrying about whether or not those two people are meeting with one another, Senator Rounds said. Since his pre-Thanksgiving dinner with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, Donald Trump also has said he did not know who Nick Fuentes was when the latter, who joined scores of other white nationalists in attending the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that turned violent, came to dinner at Mar-a-Lago as a guest of Kanye West. The dinner was intended to be Kanye and me only, Trump said in a post on his Truth Social platform, shying away from direct criticism of Nick Fuentes. Before Senate Republicans returned to Washington on Monday evening, one of their own had already tweeted, with notably sharp criticism. Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator from Louisiana who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial, sought to put distance between Trump's actions and the Republican Party as a whole. President Trump hosting racist anti-Semites for dinner encourages other racist anti-Semites, Senator Cassidy tweeted. He added, "These attitudes are immoral and should not be entertained. This is not the Republican Party."
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of Moroccans have staged demonstrations across the North African country to reiterate their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and voice outrage at the U.S.-sponsored normalization of diplomatic relations with Israel on its second anniversary. People from all strata of society heeded a call by the Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization, took part in nationwide rallies in almost 30 cities to show solidarity with Palestinians and censure Rabat's normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Protesters converged outside the Parliament of Morocco premises in the capital Rabat, where they chanted slogans in condemnation of the normalization and demanded the reversal of the agreement. The demonstrators waved national Palestinian flags and held up placards that read, "Normalization is treacherous and the struggle will carry on until the normalization is revoked," in Arabic. The participants also set fire to the Israeli flag in front of the legislature's building. The people of Morocco have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the agreement by holding demonstrations and protests. The Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization said normalization with the regime is passionately opposed by the whole country. On December 2020, Israel and Morocco announced the resumption of diplomatic relations after their suspension in 2000 following the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada. The two agreed to normalize relations by signing a deal brokered by the U.S., making the North African country the fourth Arab state to strike such a deal with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. As part of the accord, Washington agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara region, which has been at the center of a dispute with neighboring Algeria. Algiers had condemned the U.S. decision, saying it had no legal effect because it contradicts UN resolutions, especially UN Security Council resolutions on Western Sahara. Morocco and Algeria have long been at odds over the disputed territory of Western Sahara, while Algiers-backed Polisario Front is seeking independence from Rabat's rule. Algeria cut diplomatic ties with Morocco in August 2021, citing hostile acts. Rabat controls over 80% of the territory and is pushing for autonomy under its sovereignty. The Polisario Front, however, wants a UN-sponsored referendum on self-determination. Morocco, like any other Arab country that has recognized Israel, insists it will still work for a two-state solution, but this time by engaging with Israel rather than boycotting it. Morocco clearly decided that developing its economic ties with Israel and winning U.S. recognition of its sovereignty in Western Sahara were too important to pass up. According to an opinion poll conducted by the Arab Barometer, 59% of Moroccans say they are hostile to normalization between Rabat and Tel Aviv. This shows a marked discrepancy between official authorities and Moroccan public opinion. The chasm was further exposed by the rise of several political parties that have accused the Moroccan state of betraying the Palestinian cause and collaborating with Israeli settlers. For example, the Justice and Development Party called for the closure of the Israeli liaison office during the bombing of Gaza last year. The Unified Socialist Party and the Socialist Democratic Vanguard Party showed their opposition to the rapprochement with Israel as well. They called it an illegitimate agreement. With all the opposition and outrage over inking the normalization agreement with Israel, why should Rabat do this? While the normalization was enacted in December 2020, bilateral relations between Morocco and Israel had never fully ceased in the past. In fact, in 2014, hundreds of diplomatic letters leaked by a Moroccan activist revealed that the two had been maintaining an ongoing political dialogue. Similarly, Israeli records reported $37 million US in trade with Morocco in 2017, as well as signing of several trade and economic agreements. The diplomatic normalization was simply an opportunity for the kingdom to recognize and strengthen a cooperation that has always existed.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, and everything is high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best prices for groceries and for, like, gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021 thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. The U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing the price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households. Many people in the UK are also struggling to make ends meet during Christmas time, especially when it comes to food. That is since the UK economy is suffering from negative economic growth that has led many to be food insecure. Driven mainly by soaring energy prices, UK inflation has been running high in 2022, reaching successive new records. In October, households paid 88.9% more on average for electricity, gas, and other fuels than a year ago. So it is natural then that there has been a multifold increase when it comes to people going to food banks. One sobering statistic is that there are now more food banks than McDonald's in the UK. Between April and September, more than 320,000 people in the UK walked into food banks of Trussell Trust, a leading charity fighting against hunger, for the first time, and 1.3 million emergency food parcels were provided across the country. Yet it appears that in the UK, things are a lot worse when it comes to energy bills, especially during the winter time. Families across the UK have to juggle household incomes and make a choice between staying warm or buying food.
So across the UK, we have what we call fuel poverty, which is if you have to spend 10% of your income to afford a decent level of heat and power, you're regarded as being in fuel poverty. September 2021, there are about 4 million households across the UK in fuel poverty.
And that is quite a startling fact, considering how the UK is part of the G7 group of countries. Total wages in the UK have also fallen by 3.9% annually in the quarter to October, accounting for inflation, making the cost of living crisis worse for the average Brit. The natural question is, how did things get down to this, not only for the UK or Europe, but for many other parts of the world, especially during Christmas? Putting COVID aside, the US-backed Ukraine conflict is one major reason, driving up energy prices and hence inflation. Christmas is known to be a time of giving, yet major donations have been going to Ukraine instead of citizens of the donating countries. The Kiel Institute has tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries. Out of that, 52.3 billion euros came from the United States, 29.2 billion euros from the European Union, and 12.3 billion euros from other countries, mostly the United Kingdom.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the US of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. As Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan, Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency when anti-China rhetoric began were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated. In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing one-China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the six assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and more recently had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by U.S. Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after U.S. military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting U.S. military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the U.S. and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts.
And the story also looks at the kind of hypocritical promises and pledges by Twitter. Twitter, since 2016, has promised to crack down on state-backed influence operations to shut down covert propaganda, and they brag all the time about shutting down Russian or Venezuelan or even Thai secret Twitter accounts that are run by the military. Yeah, Azerbaijan. Yeah, Azeris are always doing this as well.
Yeah.
But really, the U.S. is doing this. And Twitter, even though they promised to shut down all state-backed influence operations, they've worked hand in glove with the U.S. military, giving them special privileges for their fake Twitter accounts, these fake personalities that kind of make organic-looking conversations in Yemen or Syria or Iraq.
The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security, others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on his platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the Muslim dignitaries and Shiite scholars and ulama all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding Persian philosopher, Muslim Persian philosopher, and the founder of Muta'aliye Hikmah or philosophy. He is no one but Sadruddin Muhammad ibn Ibrahim Shirazi, mainly known as Mullah Sadra. Sheikh Mahtavi, give us some details about the early biography of Mullah Sadra.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sadruddin Muhammad ibn Ibrahim Qawam Shirazi, or mainly known as Mullah Sadra, or Sadrul Muta'allihin, is one of the great philosopher, Muslim philosopher, who was living during the 10th and 11th century. The time he was born is kind of controversial, but it is said that he was born in 979, according to lunar calendar, and passed away at the beginning, or at the middle of the 11th century. He had a kind of adventurous life, meaning that at the beginning he was living in Shiraz with his father. Then he moved to Qazvin, whereby the capital of Safavid dynasty was, and at the same time it was moving. I mean, the capital of Safavid dynasty, it was moving from Qazvin to Isfahan, which is located at the center of Iran. It is famous that he benefited from two great scholars in terms of rational sciences. He benefited from Mir Damad, and in terms of traditional and hadith and narrative sciences, he benefited from Sheikh Baha'i, two main distinguished scholars of that time and that area.
Yes.
When he was in Isfahan, since he finished his scholarly life in terms of learning and starting to teach, since the environment, I mean scholarly environment in Isfahan, couldn't tolerate his new ideas, specifically regarding the his unique approach and look upon the universe, he was forced to leave Isfahan because he reached the level that people following the ulama were excommunicating him and insulting him that he has deviated from the right path. So he was forced to leave Isfahan, coming to Qom, and even in Qom he couldn't reside in the main city. I mean, in Qom he was forced to leave Qom, kind of 30 kilometers far from Qom, in the village which is known as Kahak.
Yes.
For 7 years he stayed in Kahak. These 7 years actually is the golden time in terms of accomplishing his knowledge and introducing a new approach upon the Islamic philosophy, which was later on called Hikmat Muta'aliye, or transcendent philosophy or theophacy, which one you give the title. So after this stay in Kahak, he moved back to Shiraz under the request of the governor of Shiraz and started, as he says in his autobiography, he said, "I felt that this is the moment I have to write and present whatever I have felt and gained in those time that I was in Kahak." And we see as one of his main works, Al-Asfar al-Arba'a, which present the idea of Hikmat Muta'aliye, was produced at that time, that later on in our discussion for today we are going to talk about it.
Inshallah, we'll go and more details. But Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's get to Hikmat Muta'aliye, his main philosophical approach. We know that after Masha and Ishraq philosophy, or it's better to say philosophical approaches in Islam, Hikmat Muta'aliye is the last, we can say, in the line of the philosophies. What is it and why is it called Hikmat Muta'aliye?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are some discussions among philosophers that, okay, what does exactly mean this term, Hikmat Muta'aliye? Some would say that this school of thought is a combination of the Hikmat al-Ishraq and Hikmat al-Masha. That one of them was relying on reasoning, intellectual reasoning or rational reasoning, and the other was relying on the intuition and just asceticism and the mystical approach.
Yes.
So they say that, okay, Sadrul Mutaahilin tried to combine and merge these two school of thought and introduce a new school of thought. So it's not a new one, but it's a combination of these two.
Okay.
Another idea here amongst the scholars is that this Hikmat al-Muta'aliye is not a mere philosophy, but rather it's a mixture between philosophy and mysticism or irfan.
Okay.
That, so it adds some mystic issues, especially from Ibn Arabi, and merge these issues and, you know, mix these, you know, stuff with philosophical stuff, so that now there is a new dress put on philosophy that these some matters are new in this, you know, school of thought. But when you want to analyze it exactly, they say, these scholars, yes, they say that you may come to this deduction that, okay, it's a mixture of philosophy and mystery.